In our study tonight, we want to review just a fairly little bit from Daniel chapter 2. You covered a whole lot of that in the last two lessons. We had talked about Daniel chapter 2 in our previous lessons, but it still becomes a springboard into New Testament studies. In Daniel chapter 2, King Nebuchadnezzar saw an image. What did he see? Jenny? And then what did that mean, David? That image that King Nebuchadnezzar saw, what did it mean?
Different. We're going to rule.
All right. Beginning with whom?
He was the God. He was the head of God.
Yes. Who was that?
That was Nebuchadnezzar.
King Nebuchadnezzar, yes. All right, good. And then what?
And then silver. Is that the Medo-Persian Empire?
All right.
And then there was brass, which I believe would be Greek.
All right. That's what you talked about last Sunday morning and last Wednesday night.
Of course, the real strong one would be iron.
All right.
That would probably be Roman.
All right. So we've got the iron, and yes, that represents the fourth empire, and we know that to be the Roman when we begin to count. And go ahead.
The one thing that will never be destroyed.
All right. God is going to set up His kingdom, which shall never be destroyed. Now, by way of contrast to those temple kingdoms, God's kingdom would not be destroyed. Now, in reference to some of those things, you studied quite extensively regarding the expansion of the Roman Empire, how that began. And we've talked about that in times gone by as well. We know, and you discussed this in some detail, Julius Caesar, who began to spread his kingdom by going into battle with Carthage about 200 years before Christ, then expanded over into the area of Spain. And then you talked about Pompey and his efforts just a little bit later, about 197 B.C. At that particular point in time, did Rome have a significant king, a single king? No. No, you talked last time about this republic that existed in Rome at the time. But we do find these two characters rising to great positions of power through their expansion. Julius Caesar going that way and Pompey going this way. And eventually Pompey came over into the area that we now recognize as Asia. What was taking place during that time in Jerusalem? Maccabees, yes. What was it that the Maccabees were fighting? This was a period of time you discussed last week too. What was it that the Maccabees were fighting?
Well, were they fighting two things? Amongst the Jews, and then for a moral system or something, and also against probably the Romans.
Okay, before the Romans came to be, we've got Syria over here that has risen to power. And Syria wanted to dominate this area of Palestine. Now, why do you suppose they wanted to do that? Trade, commerce, money seems to be always the key element, political clout and so forth. But when Syria took Jerusalem, you studied last week, and we discussed this briefly before I left, a ruler by the name of Antiochus. And what was it that he did when he marched on the city of Jerusalem? All right. Did a whole lot of horrible things, and that prompted the Maccabean revolt to take back the city of Jerusalem and the temple and restore temple worship and all of those things in about 167 B.C. Now, interestingly enough, Pompey, though he's up here, doesn't march down here until later. And I find that quite significant. What was happening in Syria after the Maccabeans drove them back?
They were weakening
them
and making them ready for Rome.
Yes, they surely were. Who else was now fighting against Syria? Parthians, thank you. I started to say Persian. The Parthian Empire. And also over here to the far east, we know that India is over there, and from what I understand, they were pressing the territory of Syria. So you've got the Maccabees doing this, the Parthian Empire doing this, and the Indian Empire doing this, and then what does Pompey do? Yes, he does. He marches right on down through Syria, and Syria then became a Roman province in 64 B.C. Now, do you see how these become building blocks for the things that we're going to be talking about in our study as New Testament time begins?
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. But you've got Pompey at 197 B.C. is going to have to be horrifically old in order to...
Yeah.
Okay, I rearranged this chart from another one, and I may have gotten them out of order. I apologize for that. But what we have him doing is marching here, and I may need to adjust the dates just a little bit. But what we have is a series of events that result in Pompey not only entering into the city of Jerusalem, but what does he do to the temple? And first of all, before we answer that, why does Pompey wait till an appropriate time to march into the city of Jerusalem? Well, yeah, you know, your enemy is my enemy, and so forth and so on. And so he's just sitting on the back burner waiting until the right time to march through Syria and then to march into the land of Palestine, in particular the city of Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem was conquered by Rome in about 37 B.C., and as we see this series of events, we see what's evolving here. We see that Rome is expanding its territory around the Mediterranean Sea. Now, why would they do that? You mentioned it earlier, Melissa.
Commerce.
That's right. They want to control everything that is around the Mediterranean Sea. I found it interesting, Richard, on your presentation, I believe it was last Sunday, that this is called the Middle Sea. And indeed, it's in the middle of the known world.
And the word Mediterranean probably has to do with middle as well.
It probably does, yes. It probably does. But this series of events are to set the stage for the things that we want to talk about in our study tonight. Now, Octavian was declared to be the first emperor, given the title Augustus Caesar. And as we begin, this is one of the points, Richard, I believe that you made in the concluding remarks of your study Sunday morning regarding the beginning of the kings of Rome here with Octavian. In Luke chapter 2, beginning in verse 1, it says, "Now it came to pass in those days, there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be enrolled." This was the first enrollment made when Quirinius was governor of Syria. "And all went to enroll themselves, everyone to his own city. And Joseph also went up from Galilee out of the city of Nazareth into the Jordan, into Judea rather, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and family of David." We want to talk about that somewhat extensively as we pursue our study tonight. But these, Richard, are on the charts that we've purchased, and I left them just to review some of these things. Pompey given the charge of conquering the eastern shores of the Mediterranean as much as or as little as 50 miles inland on all its shores. The western shores were already in Rome's control, as we saw that Caesar had conquered that portion. And now all the northern shores have been subdued. Now Syria is subdued, and he starts down the coastline, and of course Palestine and eventually Jerusalem is involved in that. Now, one of the things that I didn't mention is what did Pompey, when he came toward Jerusalem, there was somewhat of a underhanded, I guess, approach to the city, noting that they were in trouble with Syria. Rome had done what for those who were Jews? Well, Rome pretended to be friendly, didn't they?
Yeah, they sort of, for a little while or something, let them govern themselves.
All right, they did do that. They allowed them to pursue, to appear to be friendly. All at the same time, when Syria is being weakened, what's happening to the land of Judea, or in particular, Palestine? Well, that's true. During the days of the Greek culture, that was being done. But when you have a battle that takes place between two countries, both are injured. And so you have the land of Palestine weakened, you have Syria weakened, and it becomes just open season on Palestine from Rome. And so Rome marches on the city of Jerusalem and now finds that, as it implies, it's there to help, that during this period of Maccabean revolt, there's somewhat now of a civil war that's taking place at the conclusion of this. And so Pompey enters the city of Jerusalem, and rather than to solve the conflicts between the conflicting parties of the Jews, what does he do? He does. Yes, he broke down a portion of the wall, walked into through the Holy of Holies in the temple, and this created all kinds of problems, but nonetheless, he was successful in conquering the city of Jerusalem. Now, earlier, I know in our study, we talked about how that Pompey marched on down into Egypt, and there he was eventually ordered to be killed by Ptolemy the 10, 11, 12th in 48 B.C. And then Julius Caesar followed Pompey to Egypt. And you talked about this rather extensively in your last study, as you talked about the role of Cleopatra and the number of folks that were called by that name. And you sure can. If I know the answer to it, I'll try.
Okay, I'm getting ready. I need to go home and make a timeline.
Yes.
Antiochus Epiphanes desecrated the temple 167-ish?
Yes.
Okay, now when Pompey came in, he did you just say he did the same?
Essentially, he marched right into the Holy of Holies.
Okay, now how did they get that back? Because by the time Christ is born, religious things are going along pretty good. Were they able to get that back?
Well, let me do some work on that. I don't know if I can answer
that's
you readily.
Like 50-ish years.
Yeah,
ago.
Yeah.
Okay. So, looking for that?
Yeah. I too need to put together a timeline. The original chart I had up there, though it had an error in it, was my efforts to do that. And I need to fix that error and include the point that you just asked. I don't know the answer to that. Does someone else have a theory or an idea or some evidence?
Pardon me? I thought Rome kind of left
them
alone. If they didn't cause trouble, didn't they let them just do their thing?
But eventually, they allowed them to have their own government. But it was after, I believe, that Pompey established authority over them.
Well, not knowing anything about that particular Pompey episode, the thing is that when Antiochus Epiphanes went away back much earlier, then the Maccabeans and the others that were there managed to cleanse the temple.
Yes.
And get it the way it was supposed to be. And so that's where they came up then with the Festival of Lights and
right.
That sort of stuff. And so that went for, what, like 75 years or something?
Yeah.
Maybe it was more like
the Feast of Dedication that was existent
until
Jesus.
Pompey comes in.
Yeah.
I found that. That's on 163 paragraph where he walked into the Holy of Holies.
Okay.
But he didn't do the same stuff that the other guys did, to that extent?
Not to that extent, but the fact that he was able to walk into the Holy of Holies, he was not authorized to do that. And the Jews just stood appalled that he would do such a thing. So Pompey, not being a Jew, not being a Levite, this desecrated the temple.
So that was something like 100 or so years after the Holy
Yeah, but he didn't, to my knowledge, he didn't do anything like offer swine on the altar and that kind of thing that had been done by Antiochus. Okay, good question. Where do I want to be now? Oh yes, back to Daniel. Back to Daniel. We've studied about how, and these maps are so very important. I don't know if you can see these from back there. These are on the purchase maps that we have. And if you can't see them, I'll go back. I have individual maps of each of these. Connect those of you in the back. James, can you see this? Okay, can you see this little pink dot on that map? All right, excellent. What we want to note is here is how the land of Palestine has changed hands over the years. We note that the Assyrians conquered the city of Samaria when? 722, 721. I have to mention both of those because it depends on what sources you're reading from. And the small little kingdom of Judah, Assyria, was not able to destroy it by conquering the city of Jerusalem. But I want to ask, during whose reign was this attempt by the king of Assyria? During the reign of Hezekiah. Hezekiah was ruling in Jerusalem when the Assyrian king sent the ambassage down and with his army and his captain of his army, Rabshakeh, I believe was his name, to tell King Hezekiah, you need to surrender because you just can't win. The gods of all these other nations, they could not deliver them, and your God cannot deliver you. And this is the part that
Yeah. Not Rabshakeh.
Okay. Is it Sennacherib?
Yeah.
Was Sennacherib the king?
He was the one who...
Or the captain of the army?
He was the one whose army woke up.
Woke up dead, yeah. Well, now there was a Sennacherib and there was a Rabshakeh,
yeah.
And I'm failing to recall which one was the captain of the army. You may be right. But you've raised the question in my mind. Now I've got to answer it. Sennacherib was... I think Sennacherib was the king. I've got the account in the Kings. The account in Isaiah is found in where? Isaiah chapter
115 in the book is the, you know, the chart of the kings.
Uh-huh.
In Hezekiah's 14th year, Sennacherib of Assyria came up against all the fenced cities. But is he, I thought he was the army general.
I think he's the king, and I think the Rabshakeh was his, yes, his field commander. Here I have it in my notes. Isaiah 36, much of it is discussed there, but I'm reading from 2 Kings 18, 2 Kings 18, in verse 28. Then Rabshakeh stood and cried with a loud voice in the Jews' language and spake, saying, "Hear ye the word of the great king, the king of Assyria." So he's simply the messenger, the captain of the army, as it were. But we noted that Assyria was not able to destroy the city of Jerusalem. But the threat was, and as I generally asked Randy, the rule that existed between God and his people was... All right, you do what I say, I'll bless you, don't I'll curse you. And here's Hezekiah over here obeying the Lord. And the king of Assyria, though he had conquered so many other nations, was not able to conquer the small little dot on the page, the kingdom of Judah, because Hezekiah was obeying the Lord. But we find that subsequently, after Hezekiah, there were other kings. And not all of them were faithful to obey the Lord. And what happened in about 586 or so over here to the city of Jerusalem?
It was destroyed.
We've got the Babylonian Empire now ruling. Same land, but different ruler. And then we find that the Persian Empire now comes into play and conquers Babylon, and you don't see Babylon anymore on the map. And this is what you talked about last time, how that the Grecian Empire expanded to almost to India, and either met with opposition. I certainly did meet with opposition, but the story is told that Alexander sat down and cried because he didn't have any more to conquer. Others have said his soldiers cried because they were tired of fighting. But then we find the existence of the Roman Empire, as we've just discussed, and this begins our New Testament period of these things. Julius Caesar was murdered in 44 B.C. Cleopatra was involved, and I think you discussed this, in a power struggle between Mark Antony and Octavian. Octavian defeated them in 31 B.C., and Egypt then became a Roman province. And this expands, of course, the reign or the dominion of Rome. Open your Bible now to Luke chapter 1. Luke chapter 1. Now, I've asked you to do some reading and studying in the book of Luke, but I want to preface some of our studies with some questions about the book of Luke. First of all, was Luke a Gentile or a Jew?
Gentile.
He was a Gentile, yes. And why is that significant to the context of Luke? In my efforts to get folks to study about the life of Christ, I say read the book of Luke. If you're wanting to get a chronology of the life of Christ, Matthew and Mark give us a chronology of the life of Christ. They give some details. John is not written to be a chronology. It's written to provide evidence that Jesus is the Christ. However, Luke is written from the perspective of a Gentile. And who are the ones that it is intended for? Who are the recipients? Who is it written to? Jews or Gentiles? It's written to Gentiles. It's written to Gentiles. Now, we're not going to explore all the reasons why I believe that's true, but I want you to back up and look at some things unique about the book of Luke that will lead you, I think, at least to that conclusion. When you start in chapter 1 of the book of Luke, who are you reading about? The beginning of John. That's right. Zacharias and so forth, and we'll talk about that. The beginning of the life of John. Look, if you will, in Luke chapter 1, verse 3. Luke chapter 1, verse 3. It says, "It seemed good to me also, having traced the course of all things accurately from the first, to write unto thee in order, most excellent Theophilus." What does that tell us about the Gospel of Luke versus the other Gospels?
If you want to make a timeline,
you use Luke. That's right. I'm not suggesting that the others are not helpful, but they're not intended to be, and nor are they stated to be, in chronological order. But Luke is. These things are given in order. Now, when Luke begins with the prophecy to Zacharias regarding the birth of John the Baptist, do you read that back over in Matthew and Mark, and do you read that in John? No. What I want us to see is that the Gospel of Luke backs up the farthest of any of the four Gospel accounts. And as you continue reading toward the end of the Gospel of Luke, what will you find that it does? It does. It goes well beyond the death. In fact, beyond the resurrection. And there includes the instructions of the Lord to go to the city of Jerusalem and wait there until you receive the promise of the Most High. Now, the point being established here, the point that I'm trying to make, is that though you have Matthew's account of the Great Commission, Mark's account of the Great Commission, you have just a blip of what we will call the Great Commission in the Gospel of John.
Mark was written for the Romans.
I believe that's correct.
Because it was like very straight to the point.
Yes. Yes. But when you read Luke, he goes beyond the Great Commission unto the apostles. He extends even to the promise of the coming of the Holy Spirit upon the apostles and where they're to go that they will receive this. Now, when you begin the reading of the book of Acts, the only New Testament book that is a book of history, where does it begin? All right. Right where Luke left off. to Luke just a little bit.
23 and 47.
Yes. And so what we have is the book of Acts written by Luke attaches itself very naturally to the Gospel of Luke. So when we begin our study of New Testament chronology and the beginning of the preaching of the Gospel, we know that the Caesars are reigning. Luke chapter 1. We know that during the reign of the Caesars, some events take place, and we want to talk about those. I want you to look on the board. I think these are in your lesson book, and if not, they should be. The Caesars, as it were, of the Roman Empire, the beginning, we find Octavian was given the title Augustus Caesar, then there was Tiberius, and then Caligula, and then Claudius, and then Nero, beginning in about 54. Now the significance of this is to help us to see that when we talk about Caesar, we're not just talking about one fellow, much like you were discussing, Richard, in the previous study about Cleopatra. There's not just one person that bears this name. It becomes then a title. And there are different characters that are identified in Scripture by the term Caesar. And we want to know what character we're talking about. For example, when you're reading in Acts chapter 11, beginning in verse 27 through verse 30, we see that a fellow by the name of Agabus came down from Jerusalem to Antioch, and he prophesied concerning the coming of a famine. And then the writer tells us, which came to pass in the days of Claudius. What's that telling us? That this famine occurred during this frame of time. And so the events that are transpiring at the close of Acts chapter 11 and about the first half of Acts chapter 12 occurred during this time frame. So when you're talking about a timeline, Carolyn, of history, and you look at the book of Acts, you can make a timeline. Because you have certain events that you can attach to that timeline that are definite. So you know when certain things occurred. Now, understanding that, understanding when Jesus died, when the church was established, understanding some of the dates on the timeline that the book of Acts addresses, about what time of history, in terms of years, does the book of Acts cover? Just to guess would be good. 30, about 30 years. 18, thereabout. About 30 years. And that's a good estimate. But it helps us to see that during this period of time, we're talking about the reign of different men during which the book of Acts is written, a book that, as you well know, I love to study. And I love to teach it because of the implications that are in it and the lessons. But one of the things that I was talking with Caitlin about earlier when we were discussing this time period, we often learn the books of the Old Testament. Then we learn the books of the New Testament. And we sometimes think that the Old Testament closed with Malachi and then we have the writing of Matthew. And that's not the case, as we well know. There was a period of 400 years when God did not communicate anymore with His people. No more communication from God. Now we know that, and help me to remember, I believe it was Amos, that God said through Amos that there would be a famine. Not of food, but there would be a famine of His Word. And here we see during this 400 year period, God did not speak to His people. It was a period of silence. And when we begin in Luke chapter 1, we read of the angel Gabriel appearing unto Zacharias and informing him that he and his wife were to have a son and that he would be named John. Now I want to turn again to Luke chapter 1, and I want to call upon you to read along, or preferably, James, if you would read for me some passages as we go through this. Begin, if you would please, at verse 5 and read through verse 7 for now. We'll talk about that and then proceed a little bit.
There was in the days of Herod, king of Judea, a certain priest named Zacharias, of the course of Abijah, and he had a wife of the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. And they were both righteous before God, walking in all the commandments and ordinances of the Lord, blameless. And they had no child, because that Elizabeth was barren, and and they were both were now well stricken in years.
All right, two or three things I want us to notice. Number one, the angel Gabriel, yes, but before I get into that, I want to talk about Zacharias and Elizabeth. Zacharias, of the course of Abijah. We know that the service of the high priest kind of rotated. We'll perhaps have occasion to talk about that a little bit more later. We don't just have a priest and he's there all the time, so you can go in and talk to the priest. What we have is a rotation of priests, and they serve at appointed times. We notice that this is the time when Zacharias was serving as priest. And he's the text tells us that, verse 8, he's executing the priest's order before God in the order of his course. That suggests this rotational cycle of the priest. But I want to say something about Elizabeth and Zacharias. They're old, but they're both righteous. What does that tell you about Zacharias and Elizabeth? Is their faith dependent upon constant and continual communication with God? No, God hasn't spoken 400 years. Now, you made this point Sunday, I believe, Richard. Approximately how old is the history of the United States? 220 years, thereabouts. Now, when you look at that, you go back 400 years. What was happening in this land?
Pilgrims were coming in.
Pilgrims were coming in. Yeah. Now, you might trace back 400 years, and you're into ancestry and putting together the family trees and all of that thing. You might go back 400 years, and you might find somebody that's related to you that didn't do anything of significance, has no particular record of anything that they've done, just in your genealogy. But does that mean that their life was not significant? Well, no, that's not the point. But what do you know about it? What impact did they make on the world? Nothing in particular. And here's somebody that all you know about them is perhaps, if you're fortunate, their name. You don't know what they did. You don't know how they lived. You don't know what religion, quote-unquote, they were. You don't know how they reared their children. You don't know what their political position. You don't know anything about them. Now, when you trace history of this area of Palestine back 400 years, how many events took place that really aren't recorded for us? Well, you don't know, but one of the things we do know is God did not communicate. We know that. And all the communication that Zacharias and Elizabeth was aware of is what God had previously said. And now here, 400 years later, they're still doing what God had said. What does that tell you about Zacharias and Elizabeth? Well, the text tells us they were righteous. Another point I want us to see, very, very short-lived point, is they were unable to have children. Unable to have children, but that didn't affect their faithfulness. But all during this time of growing old and unable to have children, they are perfecting their ability to be good parents. They are righteous. And in this time, it tells us, beginning now of James in verse 8, if you would read down through verse 13 for me, that would be helpful, please.
Now it came to pass, while he executed the priest's office before God in the order of his course, according to the custom of the priest's office, his lot was to enter into the temple of the Lord and burn incense. And the whole multitude of the people were praying without at the hour of incense. And there appeared unto him an angel of the Lord standing on the right side of the altar of incense. And Zacharias was troubled when he saw him, and fear fell upon him. But the angel said unto him, Fear not, Zacharias, because thy supplication is heard, and thy wife Elizabeth shall bear thee a son, and thou shalt call his name John.
Oh, how important that passage is. Thou shalt call his name John. Did Zacharias just immediately believe what the angel told him? Now keep in mind, there's been no communication from God for 400 years. Zacharias is the first one to receive some kind of message from God in 400 years. How does he react to it? Verse 14, James, down through verse 17, please.
And thou shalt have joy and gladness, and many shall rejoice at his birth. For he shall be great in the sight of the Lord, and he shall drink no wine nor strong drink, and he shall be filled with the Holy Spirit even from his mother's womb. And many of the children of Israel shall be turned unto the Lord their God. And he shall go before his face, the spirit and power of Elijah, to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the disobedient to walk in the wisdom of the just, to make ready for the Lord a people prepared for him.
All right, notice that the angel does not just tell Zacharias, you're going to have a son. But he tells Zacharias, here's what he's going to do. He's going to prepare the way for the Lord. He will go before the face of God. He shall go before his face, rather, in the spirit and power of Elijah. What passage does that call to mind? Old Testament passage. John would go forth in the spirit and power of Elijah. What was it that Malachi said as he closed his writing? Malachi chapter 4. All right, let's go just to the last couple of verses of Malachi. What does he say? 4, 5, and 6. Yes, Carolyn, would you read that for me, please?
Chapter 4?
Yes, please.
4, 5, 6. But he answered and said, it is written, man shall not live on bread
alone. No, Malachi. You're in Matthew. Go back a few pages.
Remember the law of Moses, my servant, even the statutes and ordinances which I commanded him in Horeb for all Israel. Behold, I am going to send you Elijah, the prophet, before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. He will restore the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers, so that I will not come into my land with a curse.
All right, James, would you go back and read verses 16 and 17 for me, please? Luke 1. All right, now if the angel said that to you, would you think, oh yeah, Malachi chapter 4?
Probably not.
And neither did Zacharias. But we can't help, or I can't help, but calling the question, well, why not? You see, as we look at these Old Testament prophecies, they're very specific. Many of them are so very specific. And when we look at this one, does your mind go back to the words of Malachi? God will send Elijah. And what will he do? He will turn back the people. Let me get it here correctly.
So that had to be prophesied over 400 years in advance.
Yes, sir. Turn, he shall, I'm going to read that. Many of the children of Israel shall he turn unto the Lord their God. Turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the disobedient to walk in the wisdom of the just, to make ready the ways of the Lord. Now, certainly the Old Testament, the words of Malachi, prophesied concerning the coming of Elijah. But who was that? Who was Malachi prophesying about? Was that Old Testament prophet Elijah going to arise from the dead and begin to speak to the people of God and to turn them from the things that were wrong and turn them back to God? Is that what Malachi was prophesying?
John would be like Elijah.
That's right. 6 months later, I'm going to come back to that thought in just a little bit. 6 months later, Gabriel appears to Mary in Nazareth. And she's told that she's going to have a son. And his name would be called Jesus. Now, I mention that here because of the timeliness of it and the context of Luke chapter 1. But James, I want you to continue reading, if you will, please, beginning at verse 18 and read down through verse 25, please. Luke chapter 1.
And Zacharias said unto the angel, whereby shall I know this? For I am an old man, and my wife well stricken in years. And the angel answering said unto him, I am Gabriel that stand in the presence of God. and I was sent to speak unto thee and to bring thee these good tidings. And behold, thou shalt be silent and not able to speak until the day that these things shall come to pass, because thou believest not my words, which shall be fulfilled in their season. And the people were waiting for Zacharias, and they marveled while he tarried in the temple. And when he came out, he did not speak unto them, and they perceived that he had seen a vision in the temple. And he continued making signs unto them, and remained dumb. And it came to pass, when the days of his ministration were fulfilled, he departed unto his house. And after these days, Elizabeth his wife conceived, and she hid herself 5 months, saying, Thus hath the Lord done unto me in the days wherein he looked upon me to take away my reproach among men.
All right, let's pause there. What was Zechariah's reaction to the words of Gabriel?
Say what?
Yeah.
Kind of like Abraham and Sarah.
Yeah. You know, when you consider how old I am, it just can't be. How shall I know? And there was a sign that was given to him. And what was it?
Silence.
He would not be able to speak until these things were fulfilled. And indeed, when Elizabeth conceived, we find that she recognized that this was the Lord's doing, that he was taking away her reproach. Now, verses 26 through verse 33, we're going to pass over for just now. We'll come back to that a bit later. Yes.
Could you confirm, I wasn't sure what you said earlier, was Zacharias a high priest or a priest?
He was a priest,
okay.
Yeah.
And
did I say high priest?
No,
okay.
I wasn't sure.
No, he's just identified here as a certain priest.
Okay.
I think you had the real high priest and then one that Rome put in there as kind of a puppet. So you had two at the same time.
Yes, you have that by the time of the execution of Jesus. Yes, you have Caiaphas and you have, what's the other guy's name?
I can't remember now.
Well, you can read it in about Matthew 26, I believe. Annas.
Annas.
Thank you. Thank you. Annas and Caiaphas.
So was John a Nazarite?
Well, no, he would be a Levite.
Oh.
He'd be a Levite. Now he would... John, you're asking me if John was a Nazarite.
Because he drank those strong wine and then the way he dressed.
Yeah, many of the things that were required of the Nazarites, I think, were seen in John, but I don't believe he was a Nazarite. He was a Levite. Now, keep in mind, I'm getting confused. Keep in mind, the Levites, these were a descent of people based on their lineage. Nazarites were people based on the city from which they came.
Nazarenes.
Nazarenes. Okay. A Nazarite is somebody who
took on the vow. Took on the vow. Okay, John did not have the vow, but he had some of the characteristics. Pardon me?
As far as we know. Yeah. Now, the thing is that we need to remember that all of these folks were of the tribe of Levi, but it was only the people who were of the portion of the tribe of Levi that were through Aaron that could be priests. All the other servants that
right.
carry things and do stuff around the temple and stuff, but they didn't perform the spiritual service.
Right.
And then some portion of those people were high priests.
Right, right. I think we see that, you may have mentioned this, with the carrying of the Ark of the Covenant. The sons of Eliezer were to carry the Ark of the Covenant, but they weren't priests in the sense of being the high priest or serving in official capacity. Yeah.
Well, we're Monkey Ranch. Elizabeth and Mary are some kind of cousins.
Yeah.
Related.
Now, is Mary of the tribe of Judah? Like, did they marry between
That's
the
so interesting that you would ask that. Mary of the tribe of Judah. We're going to, and I'll have to get the chart out to demonstrate this, but what we're going to see is that both Mary and Joseph, the lineage of both, go back through David. Now, what does that tell us? They were both of the tribe of Judah.
So she and Elizabeth being cousins, right? Somebody married somebody between tribes. That was allowed.
As far as I know, marrying between tribes was all right, but marrying outside of the nation of the Jews was not. Okay, that's an interesting question. I don't think I've ever been asked that before. Now, concerning this prophecy that was being made unto Mary in these next few verses, we learn that Mary is told in verse 31 of chapter 1 of the book of Luke, "And behold, thou shalt conceive in thy womb, and shall bring forth a son, and shall call his name Jesus. And he shall be great, and he shall be called the Son of the Most High. And the Lord God shall give unto him the throne of his father David. And he shall reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there shall be no end." Now let's pause there and talk just a little bit about that. "Of his kingdom there shall be no end." What was it that Daniel explained to King Nebuchadnezzar? That's right. What was it that Nathan the prophet had explained to David back 1,000 years B.C.?
That if his seed, God would set on his throne, he would reign forever.
All right. Do you see any of that in what's said to Mary? Well, yeah. Yeah. That's exactly what's said to Mary. Now, I want you to look at this for just a moment. Let's go back and talk about John. When you turn to Isaiah chapter 40, now how long before Christ did Isaiah prophesy? About 700 years plus. Now, in the reading of the book of Isaiah, how do I want to ask this? What kind of subject matter, in other words, what's going on in Israel at the time that Isaiah is prophesying? What's happened? Remember now, it was Isaiah.
I'm trying to picture a timeline in my head right now.
It was Isaiah that quoted the words that we read in 2 Kings 18 about King Hezekiah. Recorded that history. So it backs us up to the days of the Assyrian kings. Okay? Backs us up to the days of the Assyrian kings. Just before Daniel. Yeah. Would be just before Daniel. That's going to be significant, as you see on this chart. All right, we'll stop.